joining us this evening. I know that Sunday evening, there's always a lot going on, preparations for the week and so on. So I'm glad that everybody is joining us, and to those who are still coming in, I want to thank Bayit and Shir Shamayim in particular for, in general, co-presenting not only the program this evening, but the entire week of our Shavuaton on Jewish identity. I do want to note for people, I'm recording video this evening. I'm going to be putting it on speaker view so that the speaker will be the one who is front and center, but I want to make sure that people are aware that this is happening. Our Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, has a tradition of holding Shabbatonim at shuls around the GTA, usually about 9 or 10 of them. And in particular, in the fall and in the spring, we hold Shabbatonim at the Bayit and at Shari Shamayim, two shuls which are very kind to give us opportunities to speak in a variety of ways, a variety of times to the community on particular themes. But when the pandemic hit last year, it became clear that we were not going to be able to hold a Shabbaton. And so we came up with a Shavuaton model instead. So that, I will share this with you now. In May, with Shari Shamayim, we held a Shavuaton on the pandemic, issues of lockdowns, issues of treatments, restarting sporting events and so on. And then at the Bayit, we held a Shavuaton on Jewish community in the age of COVID-19, on the role of the shul, on the role of the Marada Asra, on the role of the shul Kiddush, all of which are very important. And then this fall, we decided to hold a joint Shavuaton to spend a week together looking at topics of importance regarding Jewish identity. So that you can see here, this evening we have our panel discussion, Can Orthodoxy Respect Non-Orthodoxy? Monday evening, Jews and Christians. Tuesday evening, What Unifies the Jewish People? Wednesday evening, Left-Wing Politics in a Right-Wing Religion? And Thursday evening, Black and Jewish in the Jewish Community. We're going to try to spend the week looking thoughtfully at these very important issues and challenges that the community faces. And I'm thrilled to have Rabbi Karapkin and Rabbi Strauchler, two longtime friends and colleagues, and Rebbeim of mine, really, in many ways, to be our panelists on the topic of Can Orthodoxy Respect Non-Orthodoxy? I have known Rabbi Daniel Karapkin now for, more than 20 years. It goes back to when I was in my first shul in Rhode Island. Rabbi Karapkin was in Allentown. I think, Rabbi Karapkin, you were the founder of the RCA listserv back in those days, the email list, and was involved with that together. Rabbi Karapkin was my predecessor in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and I really came to appreciate him as a Rav by seeing what he built and did there. And then since coming here, Rabbi Karapkin has embraced Beit Midrash Zichron Dov and helped us to succeed, mentored quite a few of our Avreichim as rabbinic assistants at the Bayit, Rabbi Ezra Goldschmidt, Rabbi Josh Gutenberg, Rabbi Jonathan Ziering, Ezra Diena, now Rabbi Chaim Metzger, and really a good friend to the Beit Midrash, and a very accomplished Rav, and the president of the Rabbinical Council of America. I could go on and on, but I think I've made the point. Rabbi Chaim Strauchler was actually the first rabbi I met with in Toronto in my initial visit here in February of 2009. He sat on our board from the inception of the Beit Midrash, has always had, since that first meeting, a tremendous vision for the big picture, and was also interested in the nitty-gritty of what we were doing, which classes we were giving, what our ideas were, what our goals were, and has mentored many of Avreichim for us as well, as rabbinic assistants at Shari Shamayim, Rabbi Meir Lipschitz, Rabbi David Zirkind, Rabbi David Eli Grunland, Yaron Peretz, Rabbi Eliyu Abi, and now our Sgan, Rabbi Sammy Bergman. Both Rabbi Karapkin and Rabbi Strauchler also bring particularly important experience to the discussion about Can Orthodoxy Respect Non-Orthodoxy, because they've been Rabbanim in small Jewish communities, as well as here in Toronto, a larger Jewish community. where the dynamics are different. In a smaller Jewish community, as I think is well known, people get together and work together more than in a large community where they have more opportunities to be self-sufficient. So I think bringing to the table the smaller town experience and the big city experience is really important. And so I appreciate both Rabbi Karapkin and Rabbi Strauchler taking the time to participate this evening. I'm very grateful, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say. In terms of the program itself, this evening, so as you can already tell, I've muted everybody and unfortunately will not be letting anyone unmute themselves. I'm certain that people have important things to say. It's just that there's a limited amount of time and there's a lot that we need to cover. If people have questions that they want to put in for the end, assuming there's time at the end for Q&A, you can send a chat message to me, and I will be monitoring that.
Rabbi, the chat is disabled.
Right, so they can send a message to me, I believe, but not to anyone else. Can you confirm that? You can't send a message to me either. That's a unique problem. All right, I will enable the chat then, as of now, and we'll see how it goes. But I thought that people should be able to send to me. Apparently not. Okay. Thank you. So our topic is: can Orthodoxy respect non-Orthodoxy? So, I'm not in particular a fan of the word Orthodox. It has a great deal of baggage to it, but it's a shorthand that society uses, and one of my opening questions for the panelists is going to be for them to define the term Orthodox as they want to use it this evening. But the title is not as important as the topic at hand itself. And I'm going to try, to the extent that I'm able to keep myself in line, to speak less and for the panelists the chance to speak more. Because I think that this issue of respect, of Orthodoxy for non-Orthodoxy, matters a great deal. It matters in our social lives. It matters in Torah study. It matters in terms of our interactions in the community. It matters in halachic questions. It matters in families. It matters in raising children. And it's not a simple matter. To be clear, we're not talking about respecting people. Hopefully, we can all agree on respecting people, loving people, whether they observe Torah as we do or not. Learning with and from people whose approaches to Judaism differ from our own is important. But the question really is, can Orthodoxy respect ideas that are opposed to Orthodoxy, and how would that respect affect our lives in practice? So, without further ado, I am going to put this question to the panelists for their opening statement. It's actually multi-part question in one, and I'm going to ask Rabbi Karapkin first, and then Rabbi Strauchler. We'll take alphabetical order to begin with and work from there. But my question to you is this. First of all, what do respect and orthodox mean to you in tonight's conversation? As well as to please spend some time reflecting on the role of Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, Zichrono Livracha, in relations between orthodoxy and non-orthodoxy. Rabbi Karapkin.
Okay, thank you. First of all, Rabbi Torchinger, to you and Beit Midrash Zichron Do, I just wanted to say a big Yishar Kochachem, especially to you, Rabbi Torchinger, for all the work that you've been doing throughout the pandemic. I have to say, that, and I'm sure Rabbi Strauchler would agree, that for both of our shuls, your Beit Midrash has been a tremendous lifeline of programming, of Torah study, for so many of our members, and so we owe you a great debt, the community owes you a great debt, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
And this Shavua Tov is no exception to what I just said. To address the issue, and perhaps maybe we'll touch on Rabbi Sacks at the end, there's a whole historical context that we have to place on the relationship between Orthodox Judaism and the other strands of Judaism. Before the Common Era, in the first and second centuries, before the Common Era, Judaism viewed itself as threatened from within, from Hellenized Jews and from Sadducees and Essenes and other sectarian groups. And so the Pharisaic, or what would be later known as Rabbinic Judaism, always had to portray itself during that period as in a state of constant staving off of an attack of either Hellenized Jews or Sadducees. In the 9th century, you have the same phenomenon with Karaites and Rapsagigon, who was the head of the academy in Bavel, waging a battle against the Karaism. In the 19th century, you have great rabbis like the Chatam Sofer and all of his students, Rav Hirsch, waging a battle against the Reformation, against the Haskalah. And in the 20th century, you had great Rashi Yeshiva, many of whom, some of them were my own teachers, who felt that it was important to continue this battle against both the Reformed Judaism and also conservative Judaism. And there, that historical backdrop cannot be minimized. In other words, we have to understand that there has been this perennial sort of creating of boundaries around traditional Judaism and protecting the pristine quality of the halachic system of Judaism against other systems which identify as Jewish but are not within those parameters of what we would call halachic Judaism. You know, there's a statement in the Talmud Tractate Brachot which says, "Miyom shecharet beit hamikdash ein lo lahakadosh baruch hu ba'olamo ela arba amot shel halacha bilvad." From the time that the temple was destroyed, all that God can say is truly His in the world are the 4 cubits of halacha, which means sort of that confined, very, very finite, very, very visceral and real halachic observance of Judaism as the mainstay of what will continue Judaism in the diaspora. And so to whatever extent another movement within Judaism represents itself as being equal to that system, but says that a Jew does not have to live a halachic life in order to be authentically Jewish, and immediately that evokes that historical backdrop of orthodoxy, you know, circling its wagons, so to speak. Now, with all of that being said, we have to look at where we are today. And where we are today is in a very different place from where we were not only 100 years ago, not only 50 years ago, but even 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. There was a time, certainly around the late 60s, early 70s, when a number of Orthodox synagogues, what we would identify today as centrist or modern Orthodox synagogues, were actually taking down their mechitzas and becoming traditional or conservative synagogues. Today, that trend is completely reversed. The identity of the Jew today in North America is predominantly Orthodox, even though the numbers may not be totally indicative of that, but certainly with birth rates and through assimilation and basically people wholesale giving up religion completely in the public square, the primary identity of Judaism in North America today, and it's growing, and the trend is continuing in that direction, is Orthodox Judaism. And so therefore, one has to question whether circling the wagons is the correct attitude when so many Jews who are not part of Orthodox congregations are falling away so rapidly from Orthodox Judaism. So I haven't even started to touch on your answer to the question yet, Rabbi Turchiner, of what is respect and what is Orthodox. Maybe I've touched on what is Orthodox, but I don't want to monopolize the dialogue. I will say this. I will say that to say that our attitude towards non-Orthodox movements should be the same as it was 50 years ago is a mistake. I would say that an Orthodox Jew who feels in any way threatened by non-Orthodox Jewish movements is being quixotic, which means is that he's being anachronistic. He's stabbing at windmills that aren't there. Baruch Hashem, the Orthodox Judaism is strong. The other movements in Judaism are struggling, especially during COVID, to maintain their institutional integrity. And if anything, it is we who have to reach out and sustain as many Jewish institutions and as many Jews as possible and keep them as part of the Jewish community. Why should we respect non-Orthodox communal leaders? Because they're serving a vital purpose of keeping Jews Jewish. We may not necessarily agree on many theological and ideological issues, but we have to work together in order to be able to see the bigger picture. That's what Rabbi Sacks succeeded in doing so effectively. And I have a lot more to say, but I'm going to pass it over to Rabbi Strohl.
Thank you, Rick, for asking. If I can say amen to everything, certainly to the Karapkin's description of the vital role that this measure Sefrontov plays in our city in terms of bringing not just wonderful programs, but high-quality Torah to our communities. And it's just a tremendous resource that makes our city of Makom Torah in a serious and meaningful way that is really irreplaceable. And so I want to thank Rabbi Karapkin for what he said about Rabbi Torchiner and to say amen to that. I'd like to also reflect upon the question that Rabbi Karapkin raised in terms of the history of this issue, and to acknowledge that times have changed, and that's something which is very important for us to keep in mind when addressing this problem. But I'll use my time to answer Rabbi Torchiner's formulation about orthodoxy and respect. And before I do that, though, I want to focus on another word in the question, which is the word can. And I think that we need to ask not the question of can, but really must. And to say that this is not just a question of a davar reshut, but this is a question of a chova in some way. And here I'd like to challenge one of the foundational points that Rabbi Torchiner made in terms of being able to speak about non-orthodoxy as an idea without focusing on the people who are behind it. And I think that it's a bit of a false dichotomy, that ideas don't exist outside of the people who hold them. And that when we show respect for non-orthodoxy, when we're showing respect for the non-orthodox, and it's very hard to separate the person from the idea. And if we're going to be mekarev them to Torah, then we have to show ahava. There's no shortcuts in that way. And so if we are going to respect the non-orthodox, we have to do that through the process of seeing the good within non-orthodoxy. And here I want to really define orthodox not on its linguistic, straight thinking terminology, really define it sociologically. And that the orthodoxy is a sociological phenomenon of people who don't necessarily hold the same ideas, but there's a certain relationship that they have towards one another. And in this regard, it is our responsibility as this sociological Jewish phenomenon to take responsibility for all of Am Yisrael, that we cannot just build walls around our machane, our sense of people who look like us or act like us or daven like us, but we need to be able to understand that we have a harayus, or we have responsibility for the Jewish people more broadly than that. And in this respect, I think that the fights of the past are not relevant. That as Rabbi Karapkin said, we're not losing shuls. The mechitzas are not blowing up shuls, but we're losing a lot of Jews. And when non-Orthodox shuls fall, a lot of Jews fall with them. And in this respect, we need to see the non-Orthodox as our allies in defending every neshama, every Jew who's out there, who can be reached out to, can be held in the orbit of our people, is something that we have to be seeking. And if that means showing respect to the rabbis is not just a can, it's a must. We have to do everything we can to be able to hold those people close. And in this respect, I wanted to find the word respect similar to the way we do in Pirkei Avos, which is Eizeh Mechubad, Mechabed Atav Briot. And notice the term is not Mechabed, Yehudim, or Mechabed Talmidei Chachamim, but it's Briot. And in that respect, I think we need to err on the side of showing more honor rather than less honor. And that's going to make us truly honored. And I think, as Rabbi Karapkin said, the greatest exemplar of this in our generation is Rabbi Sacks. Rabbi Sacks was not a boundary maker. He got above the boundaries and being able to reach out to Jews and non-Jews. He was able to show them that a Kadosh Baruch Hu had something to say to them and how they lived their lives. Now, we need to be honest that Rabbi Sacks was able to do what he did because there were other boundary makers. Boundary makers are important. We don't just need ambassadors, we also need defense ministers. And Baruch Hashem, we have plenty of defense ministers among our Jewish people who are able to lay out those boundaries. But in this moment, when it comes to the non-Orthodox, I think we need more ambassadors.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you both. There's a lot to unpack here, and I want to note for the group here, I don't know if everybody is aware, we actually have a broad range of people in the 138 participants that we currently have. We have people on this Zoom who would identify as Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, Reconstructionist, or unaffiliated. I'm looking at the comments that are coming in that people are sending to me, and it reflects that. So this is a fascinating conversation on a lot of levels, and I would like to actually take some points from the opening statement and take them into our next segment, and that is on unity. Someone sent me a message in the chat regarding non-Orthodox Jewish leaders keeping Jews Jewish, the comment that Rabbi Karapkin had made, asking what about when a non-Orthodox rabbi will accept or even officiate at an intermarriage. That's a question that was sent to me. I was thinking about Rabbi Strauchler's comment where he used the word kiruv. Kiruv meaning to draw people in, to draw people close. And there's potentially an inherent disrespect in saying, well, I need to show you the light. And so kiruv itself raises questions in terms of respect. So I bring up both of those points in the context of asking both panelists, Rabbi Karapkin and Rabbi Strauchler, about unity. The Torah requires us to discourage sin. It requires us to attempt to educate those we believe are sinning. At the same time, we emphasize Ahavat Yisrael, the importance of a unified nation in which each of us loves each other. Is it possible to discourage sin, to say we don't accept intermarriage? Is it possible to educate others to engage in what may be called kiruv, without triggering animosity, without causing people to feel like they're being treated with disrespect? I'm going to pause my question there. There's a lot more I could say, but I'd rather hear the panelists. So I'm going to ask Rabbi Strauchler first if he could address this, and then Rabbi Karapkin.
Last week, and
to whom were you speaking?
The Dillard Fellows. It's a program by Federation in which they partner between students here in Toronto and those outside. And one of them asked me about pluralism, and they asked me about how it is that I treat and understand those who disagree with me, and how it is that that's we're able to show them respect. And I think that there's different forms of pluralism, that need to be thought through carefully, and this is also going to be very taxing with a lot of time on, and that is that our pluralism does not mean that we stop to believe firmly in our own views and what the Torah asks of us. And I don't think that in order to show respect, you have to somehow dilute the degree to which you hold your opinions to be most true. And in this regard, I would like to introduce, you might say, Rosh Chodesh Kislev that's coming up on Tuesday. But I'd like to introduce a Greek concept. I'm thinking about the battle between Hector and Achilles, that there was no lack of respect between these two warriors, just the opposite. It was because they disagreed so strongly with one another, and they fought so vehemently that they added to one another's honor in the Greek system. And I think that that's something that's worthwhile for us to consider when we speak about non-Orthodox philosophy and non-Orthodox positions about all sorts of issues, that in engaging in rigorous debate and opposing intermarriage or opposing various things that they might do, that is a sign of respect, not the opposite of that. And I think that the potential for real debate and real disagreement is something which we should be not afraid of, and we should not define pluralism in a way that would prevent that. And I think that that's a critical piece here. And to still be able to have Ahavat Yisrael through that process in not assigning malevolent intentions to our disputants around these issues. And in as much as we're able to see the greater objectives of our non-Orthodox disputants around these issues as being with a certain Lashem Shamayim, according to their view, there's a certain heavenly goal to what it is that they're trying to achieve. So we can then argue with them, because it's not personal in having a different desire for the good of our people. Therefore, I think there is an opportunity for unity around those commonalities that we share. Now, obviously, in terms of all sorts of decisions, there are tremendous differences between us. But I would also go back to the concept of kiruv that I employed earlier. I think that there's the kiruv of trying to get a person to be like you, and then there's the kiruv of wanting to get a person to be closer to God. And when we quote this idea that ohev et ha'yud in the karvan la Torah, we're not trying to make people orthodox. We're trying to make people close to the Torah. And I think that that's a different definition of kiruv, which I think is more open to the unity that we seek, and is not something that is somehow a Trojan horse towards disrespect.
Okay. So, hang on. Sorry, I'm muting myself. So I definitely appreciate what you're saying. I think some of this is going to come down to your definition of respect at the end of the day. Meaning you're employing a broad definition which allows for disagreement, and even allows for an attempt at education and correction in my point of view, and still identify that as respectful. Am I understanding you correctly?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Rabbi Karapkin?
Rabbi Meir had a teacher. His name was Elisha ben Abuya. He eventually became known as Acher, the other. He became a heretic, but he was a very wise person. And Rabbi Meir was once asked, how can you study Torah from this man, this heretic? And Rabbi Meir said, I take the fruit and I discard the peel. And I think that that's true in, you know, Ezehu Chacham Halomeid Mikol Adam, who is wise, he who learns from every person. When it comes to working together with non-Orthodox organizations, with non-Orthodox leaders on shared interests for the sake of the Jewish community, I think that the Orthodox community has to take the same approach. I would
I believe that no Orthodox Jew is going to think that he can turn to a non-Orthodox rabbi for halachic guidance. But there's nothing wrong with an Orthodox Jew turning to a non-Orthodox rabbi for their wisdom. You know, there's plenty to criticize about the non-Orthodox movements, but there's plenty to criticize about Orthodoxy as well. You know, we divide the human being between a guf and a neshama, between a body and a soul. And if I can make the analogy, the body of Judaism is the way that we live our lives, the way that we live according to halacha. The neshama of Judaism is the feeling of closeness and the efforts that we make when we pray and when we reach out to our fellow human being and try to make the world a better place. That's the neshama of Judaism. And you can't have the guf without the neshama. You can't have the neshama without the guf. If I could encapsulate what perhaps Orthodoxy's criticism of Reform Judaism and to a large extent conservative Judaism is that it embraces the neshama and has done away with the guf, with the body, with the dalet amot shel halacha, as I discussed before. But how many of our Orthodox brethren and our Orthodox institutions have wholly embraced the body and discarded the soul? Look at how much emphasis our academies place on halachic observance and Talmudic study and have discarded the neshama of Judaism. How many of us can say that we have nothing to learn about the neshama of Judaism from non-Orthodox movements? When it comes to Tikkun Olam, who has set the example, not always correctly, admittedly, but many times for social movements and for being an Or LaGoyim, a light unto the nations, for the other nations of the world, and trying to set a proper example, trying to make a Kiddush Hashem to the outside Gentile world. Generally speaking, it's the non-Orthodox Jewish communities and institutions have assumed that mantle, where Orthodox institutions have shirked that mantle, because we need to build from within. That's always been the excuse. But now's the time for us to start to look at each other and see what fruit we can take from each other and what peels we need to discard. That's what I mean. I think that's probably what is meant by respect. And Rabbi Sachs, as Rabbi Strassler correctly pointed out, that's what he stood for. He said he stood for finding the fruit and not focusing on the peel. There's plenty to criticize. And if you feel threatened by non-Orthodoxy, then you can get up at your pulpits and rail against the non-Orthodox. But how strong is your Orthodoxy if you identify your Orthodoxy by how wrong the other guys are? We've been doing that for too long. It doesn't help in the long run.
Okay. Well, thank you. A couple of people have messaged me and about Israel, and I'm going to jump within our list of questions to Israel, because I think whenever we deal with this topic, you have to ask the question not only about what's going on in Toronto, but indeed what's happening in a place where the conflicts between Orthodox and non-Orthodox have high stakes. And it's not only the questions of old of a mechitza in a shul, or people driving to shul on Shabbos, or the kashrus of swordfish or sturgeon, but, you know, regulation of marriage and divorce, regulation of kosher food, the very definition of Jewish identity, the who is a Jew debate. Is it possible for Orthodoxy to lobby for its positions on these very important and fraught issues while still embracing the respect that both of you describe for non-Orthodoxy? And I'll call to mind the example from recent months with Rav Melamed in Israel, where he had a dialogue with a Reform rabbi and was condemned and delegitimized by some within Orthodoxy for having done so. And that's not new. I mean, it may be a recent example. We saw the same thing go on with a rabbi from Lakewood, I think it was 10, 15 years ago, who wrote a book with a Reform rabbi on their dialogues. But the question stands regarding Israel. a nuanced approach, as both of you have described, an approach which says we want to embrace the Jewish people as a whole and the soul in addition to the body, or an approach which says it's not disrespectful to disagree with somebody. We can still embrace them and respect them, and even as we disagree. How does that work when you're dealing with a society that really has such high stakes involved in the interactions between the Orthodox and those who have different approaches? And I'll ask Rabbi Karapkin to please speak first.
The whole issue of determining or engineering the policies for an entire nation of Klal Yisrael, of the Jewish people. First of all, there's a major, vast difference between how that works in the diaspora and how that works in Medinat Yisrael, in the state of Israel. In the diaspora, every community defines its own standards. So I would say that largely that issue is community dependent, and each, when it comes to statuses of conversions, statuses of divorce, and other issues of zehut, of religious status. An Orthodox community governs itself by Orthodox standards. A Reform community governs itself by Reform standards, and so on. Would it be great if there was a unified standard? Of course, but then you'd have to cater to the highest denominator, which would be Orthodoxy, and that's not something that at present in most communities the conservative and Reform leadership are prepared to do. They are not prepared to abdicate that role of issues of Jewish identity to Orthodox leadership. And I respect that. Every community has a right to determine its own standards, even if I don't agree with those standards. Now, when you look at the state of Israel, it's a whole different kettle of fish. You have a chief rabbinate of Israel, which is Orthodox from its very inception. People have to remember history. Reform Judaism largely rejected the formation of the State of Israel in 1947, 1948, and was really not interested or involved. It was either secular Jews or Orthodox Jews who put their lives on the line, made ultimate sacrifices to found the Jewish state. And the secular Jews who founded the Jewish state together with Orthodox Jews said, when it comes to matters of religion, we defer to our religious cohorts, and you will define what the rabbinate is. Now, this has created a lot of heartache with people who are not Orthodox. It's created a lot of heartache with people, especially if they've gone through conversions that are not Orthodox. And it's a very confusing process, and there's a lot of bureaucracy, and there's plenty to criticize. We all know that. We all understand that. But at its core, the religious identity of the State of Israel is according to halakha as it's defined by Orthodox Judaism and Orthodox rabbis. Will that ever change? Unlikely, based on trends that we're seeing in demographic growth within the different movements. But can it change? Sure. If a whole cadre of reforming conservative Jews make aliyah en masse, then anything can change. It's all a question of demographic representation. But to expect a change in the rabbinate with nary a representation of non-Orthodox religious Jews in Israel is not only unrealistic, but I think it's unfair. I just signed a letter that was signed by a group of rabbinic leaders. I signed it as the president of the RCA. In defense of Rabbi Melamed, we didn't say so by name, but what Rabbi Melamed did by sitting down and dialoguing with a Reform rabbi in the state of Israel was met with tremendous controversy, particularly because Reform Judaism is such a minority of Judaism in the state of Israel today. But we still support what he did, because he was dialoguing with a Jewish leader who was helping Jews find their way. Perhaps not using the halachic system, but bringing Jews back to Judaism and seeing what we can do collectively to work towards the preservation of our national identity, our national religious identity, and working towards common goals of keeping communities together and keeping them strong. is something that's so vital, both in the diaspora and in the state of Israel. And so therefore, we support this kind of interdenominational dialogue, and I hope it continues and it grows.
Okay. Thank you. Rabbi Strauchler?
So to follow up on Rabbi Kropkin's point, I think it's very important as a first to distinguish between what non-Orthodoxy means in Israel and what it means in North America or around the world. And that non-Orthodoxy in Israel often implies a secular Jewish identity, and that's something very different than when we speak about non-Orthodoxy in North America, which is a religious identity, but not necessarily one which is the same sociological description that we spoke about earlier. And in this regard, I think it's important to see Israel as a nation state. And as a nation state, it is something which is distinct from what you might describe as the civil society within Israel. And the state operates based on democratic norms that Dr. Kropkin spoke about, and those norms are a function of people voting with their identities in elections. Now, with that said, though, there's still a core value that we would hope that the state of Israel would have in terms of allowing people of all sorts of ideas and values to be able to engage in the dynamics of a vibrant society. And I think that that's what Rabbi Malamed did in terms of his interacting with the Reform Rabbi. And there was a study of Israeli society that was published a couple of years ago by the Camille Fuchs, a sociologist, where she studied Jewish identity in Israel. And he noted that there's been a revolution in terms of Jewish identity in the state of Israel, where when Israel was first founded, Israeli identity was defined in opposition to Jewish identity. And of course, in the past 20 years, that's changed. And he describes what he calls Jewish-Israeli identity. And he explains a lot of political changes within Israel based upon this idea. And I think that there's a lot to be said for this concept internal to Israeli politics. But I think there's also a corollary to what's going on in North America and what Rabbi Kropkin and I were describing earlier in terms of the old paradigms of orthodoxy and non-orthodoxy and what we're advocating for, which is to some respects to get past some of those old fights and to see what are our true common goals in terms of protecting a Jewish identity, you might say a pan-Jewish identity, that is something that we're able to work together as partners in exposing as many Jews as possible to the great tool chest of meaning that the Torah gives us all, that we all are inheritors of. And if we can look to our conservative and reform colleagues as partners in spreading that Torah, that is something that will help as many Jews as possible retain their Jewish identities. And I think that there's something very similar to what's going on in Israel now, where a lot of those old lines between religious and secular, between Dati and Chiloni, just don't make sense anymore.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I actually want to pick up on something that you were saying there at the end, in terms of, so to speak, teaming up. And the following is a comment. I'm not sure there's really a question in it for the panelists, but there's a comment, and if the panelists want to respond to it, I'd be eager to hear it. Particularly in the way that Rabbi Kropkin framed the history in the state of Israel and the fact that there are Jewish institutions which are Orthodox because they started out that way. I wonder about the price of winning. And what I mean by that is it's possible that Orthodoxy gets its way, but the result is extremely detrimental to other Jews. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was asked a classic question. It comes up in all sorts of contexts. In all sorts of writers. The question of, I am an observant Jew. I am holding an event at which there is food. and I have people at the event who are going to eat and are not going to recite a bracha. They're not going to say a blessing on it. Am I allowed to give them food, hand it to them, knowing that they're not going to recite a blessing? And different rabbis have given different answers to this question over the ages. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, you're obligated to give them food. And his argument was that there's a mitzvah in the Torah, Lo sisno es achicha bilvavecha, you shall not hate your brother. And in the event that we don't give them food, then we are causing them to hate us. By not giving somebody food, everybody else is getting food, I am causing them to hate me. And that is of a greater concern than the concern that he is going to not make a bracha, because at the end of the day, when I hand him food, I'm not trying to trick him into not making a bracha. That's not the goal. Yes, that may indeed be a result. But if I don't give it to him, then I am causing him to hate me. There's more to it. There's greater sophistication to the response, and I don't mean to oversimplify it. My point is only that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and the way that he frames this issue, says you have to look at the greater point. And the bracha is not the greater point. The greater point is creating animosity among our nation. Similarly, if Orthodoxy wins, so to speak, and there's no such thing as winning, but if Orthodoxy gets its way on policy, such as the ability to control which sort of prayer services take place at the Kotel, is there a risk that we alienate the people who lose? And the result is that, you know, Rabbi Karapkin mentioned that the non-Orthodox movements may be keeping people within the orbit of Judaism. Is there a risk that we actually undermine that and send people spinning away further? If Rabbi Karapkin or Rabbi Strauchler wants to comment on that, I'd be glad to hear.
Just responds very, I guess, politically or just very cynically towards that point, which is that you're assuming that we have a command and control system where we're able to determine how we act. And this is true for institutions. When I was at Yeshiva University, we used to do Yeshiva University, but it was like a single brain. And that's not the way that certainly that institution operates, but I think most institutions don't really go that way. And it would be great if we had enough command and control, we were able to have a strategic thinking around such points about what goes on at the hotel. But to try to control three Jews, that try to control thousands of Jews, it just doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Rabbi Karapkin.
There's a phrase in the Talmud that talks about the afterlife, and it says that in the afterlife, every person will be incinerated by the canopy of his friend, which means that we're all in different places religiously. Someone who's more religious than I am will make me feel burnt and disenfranchised. The fact of the matter is, it's not just Orthodox versus non-Orthodox. Everyone has their red lines. I learned a tremendous thing. It's a very simple idea, but once in speaking with Rav Hershel Shachter, who's the Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, and the argument was made about gay marriage and acknowledging gay relationships within an Orthodox synagogue. And the question that was posed to Rabbi Shachter was, by not acknowledging a gay couple in an Orthodox synagogue, aren't you disenfranchising these people and pushing them away from Orthodoxy? And he said, yeah. That was his response. His response was yes, that religion is only elastic to a certain degree, and that's all religion. If a religion doesn't have certain boundaries, then it's really worthless. Just like a country that has no boundaries, or any set of laws that has no boundaries, it loses its value, it loses its integrity. Every religious doctrine, every faith has a set of boundaries by which it lives and by which it says, if you live within this set of boundaries, you are part of the faith, you're living your life as part of the faith. But there are boundaries. Now, the conservative Judaism has its set of boundaries. Reform Judaism has its set of boundaries. Just to give you an illustration, if a Jew says, I am a Jew, but I also worship Jesus and Muhammad and this idol that's in my bedroom, right? Well, I respect your right to do whatever you like, but even a Reformed Jew would say, but that's not really Judaism. It's something else, but it's not something that I can relate to. It's not something that I can associate with or say is part of my orbit of what how I define Judaism. There are going to be mutually exclusive positions in halachic observance between Orthodox and non-Orthodox Jews. The Kotel is a perfect example. And Robinson's Arch, which was the designated area for non-Orthodox prayer, is also a great lesson for all of us. How we can carve out space for people who observe Judaism differently from ourselves. And everyone, there are situations which, if we all play nicely in the sandbox, we can all provide space for other people to get along. And by the way, it's also a beautiful lesson in how we understand the mindset of those who claim to be disenfranchised. Go to Robinson's Arch, which I have a number of times, to go to see who is praying there. More often than not, no one's there. The Kotel is so vital to the identity of an Orthodox Jew. But the non-Orthodox Jew has fought, those non-Orthodox Jews have fought for the right to be at the Kotel, finally gained some traction, and were awarded that, and won that battle to whatever degree they feel that they have won. And the fruits of that effort have been largely to have that portion of the Kotel not embraced and not attended. And so we have to bear in mind that sometimes we can diffuse the battle by making these kinds of concessions. But at the end of the day, it's really just a question of making space for all Jews to feel like they are being listened to, they are being respected, and they have a place at the table. Doesn't mean we have to agree, and it doesn't necessarily even mean that in my Orthodox synagogue, I have to make an allowance for every different kind of Jewish practice or what a person wants. But if we don't have any boundaries at all, then we no longer have Judaism.
Okay. I would actually love to push the Robinson's Arch one a little bit further, but seeing that we're already at 9:05, and Rabbi Strauchel and Rabbi Karapkin, I sent you a question in the chat. If you could just let me know your answer to that, that would be helpful. But I'm gonna drop Robinson's. Yes, okay. Thank you, Rabbi Strauchel. So now I can tell everybody. I asked them whether we can go to 9:15. So I'm gonna shift a little bit, but not too far from what we were just talking about. We're talking about boundaries, and we're talking about the concern that being respectful to others can potentially undermine what we're trying to teach and what we're trying to promote. And that brings me to the following. For generations, halachic authorities have wrestled with the question of Orthodox participation in non-Orthodox settings. It was certainly an issue that I dealt with a lot in my shul rabbinate. I believe both of you did in yours, and still do. Entering a non-Orthodox synagogue or temple, attending weddings and funerals, participating in joint religious and educational programs, perhaps co-officiating at something. How has halachic guidance on this issue changed in recent decades? And whichever one of you would like to take this first. I lost track of who I asked to go first at this point.
I guess maybe I'll just say something very brief. I can't tell you definitively what exactly the changes have been, but there have been changes. And it really goes back to what I started with in the discussion in the evening, is that I've been a rabbi now for over 30 years, but in the last 30 years, Reform and Conservative Judaism have become less and less of a threat to Orthodoxy. And if anything, Orthodoxy needs to reach over the aisle and to start helping the other movements stay afloat. We have to get more involved with UJA and other communal organizations that have been traditionally the purview of non-Orthodox leadership, And while, you know, we can no longer afford to look inward and to be insular and to only take care of Unzura, you know, to take care of our own Orthodox community. And we have to be able to learn how to branch out. There's no, Orthodoxy no longer should feel threatened that if we go to, if I walk into a conservative synagogue for a program or for a simcha, that automatically that means I'm gonna become no longer Shomer Shabbos and I'm gonna start eating tripe. I mean, it sounds absurd when it comes out of my mouth, but there are really people who are still living in that kind of anachronistic reality. So, you know, it's perhaps there was more of a concern 30 years ago when I got started in this business. Today, especially after having gone through a smaller Jewish community where we were all vital and we needed to sit down and have lunch once a month together with all of the clergy, because that was the only way that we would accomplish things for the greater good of a small Jewish community. I think certainly that I've evolved in that as well.
Okay, thank you. And actually, before I turn it over to Rabbi Strauchler, I just remembered as you were talking that I believe in the going back a couple of decades, Rabbi Sacks was actually criticized in England when he participated in Limud, if I remember correctly.
He didn't participate in Limud. It was his successor who did, and Rabbi Sacks was criticized for not participating in Limud.
Ah, I thought he had. Okay, thank you. Thanks for the correction. Okay, Rabbi Strauchler.
So I think that it's following up on what Rabbi Kropkin described in terms of the change around this issue. In terms of practical issues that our people are facing, it's worthwhile to ask questions. And that in terms of the need to, within each of your families, within each of your social networks, to be able to be yamin mekarevet, to be able to hold relationships close, but to do so with a certain amount of wisdom is certainly worthwhile, and I encourage everyone to think about the specifics of these questions, recognizing that each case is distinct. So with Rabbi Kropkin and myself, you're not going to hear of Sag here, Leheter or Lechumra on this issue, but that each case is unique and has a lot of nuance to it, and it's worthwhile to think about it yourself and also to bring it to your Rabbanim to discuss these issues. But I'd also like to reflect upon why things have changed now. I wanted to say this in order to give praise to our predecessors, people who've occupied our chairs, people who've preceded us within the North American rabbinate. And that is to say that it's because we've had great boundary makers as Orthodox rabbis in the past generation. It's because the Mechitza battle was won. And it is because our communities have been able to defend a vision of what halachic Judaism is and to make it appealing through the investment in Jewish day school education in so many different arenas of Orthodox Jewish life that we're able to be ambassadors now. That a Rabbi Jonathan Sacks could not have existed 50 years ago. It would have been impossible because the boundaries were not formed for him to be able to cross them as an ambassador. And in this regard, there still are boundary makers that are out there, and I think it's important for us to understand what it is they're doing. And even as we might think that they're being a little bit foolish and they're fighting, you know, the last war, but the basic idea that an ambassador needs a defense minister is something that we need to be very honest about. Navakarat's at home for too, even as Rabbi Kropkin and I take a different position than those fighters might have done in a past generation in terms of these issues, we can only take our positions on their backs.
Okay.
Let me just add one more point, and here I will speak directly to anyone who's on this call who's an Orthodox Jew. I want you to consider that when the community comes together, whether it's for the Walk for Israel, whether it's for a UJA event, whether it's for some other kind of communal endeavor, quite often the Orthodox community is underrepresented. And you have an opportunity to demonstrate what an Orthodox Jew is. To the extent that you have the opportunity to participate in this community event, consider, please, that you're not just going for yourself as a consumer of a community event, but you're also going as an ambassador for Orthodox Judaism. And you have an opportunity, Rabbi Strathler called it Kirov, I'm not sure what I would call it, but it's an opportunity when someone asks you, oh, what synagogue do you belong to? You say, I belong to Shari Shemayim, or the Bayit, or Shari Tefillah, whatever shul that you belong to. You're creating a connection to your fellow Jew, and just planting a seed and letting them know that Orthodox Jews are normal people, that we are all part of the same nation. And I believe it's we have a greater responsibility, and to whatever extent that we are underrepresented, we've abdicated that responsibility.
Thank you.
Second, Rabbi Kropkin's point there, but it's very good.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm gonna close with one more question. And this is something that goes back to actually what both of you just said, both in terms of attending community events and in general in terms of our ambitions as Orthodox Jews. And it really goes back to some of the things that I said in introducing the program. I'm going to quote somebody's message to me in the chat. Someone asked me, isn't Judaism mostly about what kind of people we want to be and how we treat each other? Goes back to Rabbi Kropkin's point about the body and the soul earlier and the fact that we have both. But building on all of that, the question of education for our children. My children grew up in their youngest years in Allentown and went to the Jewish day school with kids who were identified as Orthodox, conservative, and Reform, and learned at an early age about which birthday parties they could go to and which birthday parties could be accommodated and which birthday parties simply weren't going to work out. How do you teach your children, and at what age is it appropriate to teach your children, about the fact that there are Jews who identify as Jewish, who say, we are practicing Judaism too, but it differs from Orthodoxy? Rabbi Strauchler.
This is a great question. I'm going to answer. I just begin with a story when I was a rabbi in Connecticut that I would often walk off the shul and we'd see the congregants from the shul driving home from the shul. And I think at one point the kids asked, how is it that they're driving their cars and it's Shabbos? And someone responded that they have Shabbos cars. We can't afford Shabbos cars.
just Rabbi Strauchler, let me just interrupt. I can top that. When I was walking to shul on Shabbos with my son, the Reform rabbi pulled up to wish me good Shabbos.
So I think that education is always a beautiful opportunity and a complex opportunity. And every child has their own stage in which they're able to process the information that they need to hear and they need to appreciate. And I don't think that even at a young age, we need to be afraid of difference. And this is something about the Jewish experience through time, and also the experience in Galus, that we live it as Jews where things are never simple. And the degree that we're able to convey that the Havdalot that we make, the Havdalot that we make between Israel and Ha'amim is an important Havdalah, but also the other Havdalot are also likewise important Havdalot to also be making. And I think that our children are able to handle these distinctions, be able to recognize that these are our people, Jewish and non-Jewish, or David Selim Elohim, and these are our Jewish and not and Jewish people who have Kedusha Asam Yisrael to them, irrespective of the fact that they may not be observing Judaism the way that we do. And that complexity is an inherent part of how it is that we raise our children and how we've always raised our children. And the expectation that we're going to have some sort of simple black and white vision of how the universe is organized, it's not our faith. It's not the way that, that's not the Torah that we've received.
I completely agree with Rabbi Straffler. When my wife and I moved from Pennsylvania, the small Jewish community, back to Los Angeles, we still had little kids, and we were interested in our kids joining a little playgroup in our neighborhood. We moved into what we would call the hood, which was very, very yeshivish, very what we would call charedi. And we thought, you know, here we were, we spent many years on the front lines defending Orthodox Judaism. We should come home to the Jewish, established Jewish community as the decorated warrior who has fought valiantly for his people. And we wanted our son to be part of a little playgroup, a background playgroup. And we were told that because he had Buzz Lightyear on his t-shirt, he was disqualified from being part of that playgroup because the kids in that group did not watch Disney videos. Every community makes its delineations, makes its own boundaries. And when it comes to raising children, I don't think it's right to question how a family chooses to create those boundaries. Just like we don't, you know, every set of parents has to decide what TV shows and videos they're going to let their children watch, what kinds of children that they're going to allow their kids to associate with, not just on a religious basis, but, you know, the child comes, you know, and uses colorful language because that's what the child has in the home. A parent may decide to not want their child to associate with that child. It's very, very delicate. It's extremely personal. But one has to realize that if you're going to exercise wisdom in raising your children, if you're raising your child and you send them to a school which is very diverse, then to create a very small box of restriction is unhealthy. Similarly, if you live in a very religious community that has a lot of restrictions, and you don't share in those restrictions with your children and your family, that's also very unhealthy. Choose your community carefully, and try to find that golden mean that Maimonides talks about, of allowing certain things from the outside world to enter in, but also creating semi-permeable filters so that your children have a healthy and wholesome upbringing. I think Toronto, by the way, is one of the best places in the world to raise kids. And I'm not saying that just to shout a compliment, but, you know, compared to other places where we've lived, it's a very wholesome place. The values of the larger community are very traditional for the most part. And children grow up without the billboards and the noise of the big city. It's especially born of impartial. But it's a great place to raise our kids.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Rabbi Korobkin and Rabbi Straucher. We could easily go for hours more pushing some of these points and asking some of the additional questions that we had prepared, not to mention the ones in the chat. To people who send questions in the chat that we did not address, I'm going to actually try, where I know your email address, I'll try to follow up with you after, because I think you raised points that are important that we just don't have the time for it in the overall forum. If you sent me a question in the chat and you didn't include your email address and you think I might not know it, so send it to me now, and I'll be in touch with you about it, because I think all the points that were made are crucial. But once again, Rabbi Korobkin and Rabbi Straucher, I'm very grateful for your time. To everyone who participated, watching here, sending notes, thank you as well. I'm now sharing the screen with the flyer for the rest of the Shavuot Tone. Rabbi Sammy Bergman, tomorrow evening at 8, all on this same Zoom address. From Brother Daniel to Evangelical Zionists, Jews and Christians Today. That was actually sort of hinted at in one of the comments about a Jew who chooses to worship something else and calling himself a Jew. So that's the Brother Daniel saga in a nutshell. And then we have something for Tuesday nights. From Satmar to Settler to Secular, what unifies the Jewish people? A point somebody made to me in the chat was, we're talking about Orthodoxy respecting non-Orthodoxy. What about Orthodox Jews respecting each other? So, yeah, that's an issue too. So that'll be for Tuesday night. Wednesday evening, I'll be speaking on, is there room for left-wing politics in a right-wing religion? Short answer is, Judaism isn't really a right-wing religion. We have a lot more to talk about in that regard. So join me here Wednesday evening. And then Thursday evening, Rabbi Sammy Bergman will be interviewing people. The topic is Black and Jewish in the Jewish community. Jews of color speak about their experiences, and that should be a very interesting evening as well. So thank you to the Bayit. Thank you to Shai Shemayim. I also be remiss if I did not note that the Shavuaton is dedicated by Esther and Craig Gutman in memory of Shimon Berglas, Zichron Levracha, and by Alan Arisa Litwack in memory of Mo and Rose Litwack, Zichron Levracha, with their gifts to our Day of Giving this past year. So thank you very, very much. Thank you, everybody, for being part of the program, and I look forward to continuing the conversation offline. Be well.